offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai joining you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. It's a wonderful Thursday and we are here to continue our satsang on the conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, the book that Dr. Hislop has compiled of the many interactions that he has had with Swami and he's been the conversations that he was witness to. And the last week we were going through a particular portion where it was very, very relevant, especially to the office bearers of the organization, because apart from being a devotee, apart from being a sincere spiritual aspirant, Dr. Hislop also happens to be someone who was nominated by Swami to be the head of the organization in the United States. So a lot of the discussion was based on that, what Swami expects of somebody who is holding such a role and what are the kind of actions that need to be taken when certain problems come up, and all of those discussions were there. What we are going through today is a continuation of that, but before we do all that, we'll offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet and let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem and Sairam to all our listeners. The concluding part of last week's satsang was when Dr. Hislop says that there's this particular person who is heading a center in the United States. He is very helpful and very generous when it comes to helping, but after that he's quite demanding in, you know, expecting people to adhere to certain rules, regulations, and also in showing their gratitude, in being grateful. That's how diplomatically Hislop puts it. And interestingly, Swami says there's nothing wrong in expecting gratitude. When somebody does good, one has to show gratitude. Not showing gratitude is not right. That's what Swami says, and in that sense defends the person who is doing good and expecting people to, you know, return the favor, or expecting them to be grateful for what they have received. Maybe, you know, if Swami were to speak to that person directly, he would have told him about being detached and doing everything for Swami and, you know, in a manner that is not expecting people to reciprocate. But I think when you're speaking to a person who is talking about a person who expects, Swami says, right, when good is done, you have to reciprocate. So I think, as we have said it time and again during the satsang, that it is very pinpointed at times to specific people and specific circumstances, and it might not reflect the entire general philosophy. Yes, Swami says that you have to be detached, you should not have expectation. But if you come and tell that, see, that person is doing a lot of good and but he's expecting people to do back, that is bad. Swami says, what's wrong in that? You should. If somebody is doing good, you have to sustain, you have to be grateful, you have to reciprocate, because this is what you need to hear. If that person is possibly hearing, he would have been told how he should curtail his expectations. So that is why, you know, Swami is so special for us. He personalizes it. He gives advice and he gives us solace in a personalized manner, which makes him our personal God. Continuing, Hislop says, to my mind, ingratitude to God is a great sin. And Swami says, to fail to show gratitude is wrong. To show ingratitude is a sin. There are four classes of people in the world. First, those who call everything they see as good. Second, those who call wrong as wrong and good as good. Third, those who do not make a judgment at all. In each of these three, some reason can be seen. The fourth class is those to whom everyone and everything is evil. They just do not see any good. So, Swami says very clearly that if you don't show gratitude, it is wrong. If you show ingratitude, I mean, it is like if you don't help ever, that is wrong. If you don't hurt never, and if you hurt, that is a sin. If you don't help, maybe it's wrong, but if you hurt, it is a sin. In the same way, if you don't show gratitude, it is wrong. But if you show ingratitude, you do bad to a person who has done good to you, that is a sin. And then Swami classifies these four types. The first type, who see good in everything. I think these are the people who will fit into the category of those who have surrendered to Swami in Swami's own definition. Because Swami says, those who have surrendered to me take everything that happens to them in their life as good for them. They won't complain. They won't say that this should change, this is bad, what is this, this is painful, this is boring. All these complaints won't come. Whatever happens is for my good. That is the first category. The second category is, they say this is good, this is bad. The third category, Swami says, they don't go into judging at all. They just leave it. I mean, I don't care if it is good, I don't care if it's bad. I don't want to get into judging at all. So Swami says, all these three follow some kind of a logic. But then he says the illogical and the fourth class are those who see everything as bad. They are not able to see good at all. So these are the four categories that Swami makes, and I think it would be good soul searching for each and every one of us to see into which of these categories we fall or into which of these categories we tend to most of the times.
Right. I mean, as the whole conversation is a spin-off from that point where Swami spoke about gratitude itself. I mean, I think we did make a mention of this even the last time, because very clearly, you know, this is specific to a person. So one thing is, you can look at it as Swami is probably telling his love that you misunderstood this person. This person is not of the nature that you've, you know, you've just described.
Mm.
I think that might have been the message for his love. But in general, you know, the idea that gratitude is something that should be independent of the nature who is in front of you, of, you know, whoever you're interacting with. That's one thing which Swami would say, you know, these are supposed to be your qualities. Mm. It's not necessary that the person you're being grateful to, if he's he or she is not a noble person, then that person does not deserve your gratitude. You know, Swami would say this about elders and especially parents in your life. Yes, you know, the world might judge them differently, you know, they might be doing wrong actions, but they deserve a certain amount of our gratitude, our respect in the form of our gratitude. And that should never be denied. In fact, that's one of the things which I think Vasishtha tells Bharata, you know, when, where exactly is the conversation, when Bharata comes to the forest in search of Rama, you know, trying to convince him to get him back. And I think at that point he meets Sage Bharadwaja. I'm sorry, it's not Vasishtha, it's Sage Bharadwaja.
Mm-hmm.
And Sage Bharadwaja asks him, who are your mothers? You know, introduce them to me. I heard that in your entourage even your mothers have come. So then he starts introducing, and he says, this is Mother Kaushalya. You know, she's given birth to Lord Rama. And then he introduced Sumitra. And when he comes to Mother Kaikeyi, you know, he puts his head down in shame. And then he says, you know, she is the sinful one who is, I mean, I've done, I don't know what misfortune I've done to be born as a son and all of that. So at that time, Bharadwaja gives that advice. He says, see, the world might judge a mother like anything, but for a son, there should always be the gratitude that the mother has done, you know, given life to him.
Hmm.
So a very, very profound, beautiful piece of advice. I think that is the idea of this one, and I think even the previous conversation where Swami was saying that, no, what you are supposed to do, what value you are supposed to express, that you have to express. It doesn't matter how the other person is. And what Swami is telling also, the four categories of people, very interestingly, Swami is saying there is value and there is a reason in all three except for the last one. The person who sees everything as bad, there is a reason for everything. And I mean, as you rightly said, seeing that everybody is good is a form of surrender. You know, Swami says, whatever happens is for my good, and somebody is only an agent of whatever Swami wants to happen in my life. That's a different kind of attitude. And then being practical. You know, this person is right, this person is wrong, and then carrying on your life. And clearly it can see that none of us fall purely in one category. We all, you know,
we tend towards one of them.
Right, tend towards one of them and use this in different times in our life as we go through. And third one, Swami says, is people who want to be non-judgmental. I think that's also a stage we all have been in, or a state of mind we've all been in. Where there's somebody in front of us, you want to judge that person, and then you say that, I mean, it doesn't matter to know whether that person is good or wrong. So
let me finish this transaction.
Yeah, you know, why do I need to worry about that? So let me choose to be non-judgmental. And I think that's a very practical thing in most of the cases. Because if we really look deeply, I think 90% of the cases that we judge are people who could be just left unjudged. Because it's not going to make any difference to us whether we know who they are or, you know, we don't know who they are.
We can just finish our transaction with them and go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, when we're going in the road, when we're commuting from place to place, when you're transacting with a shopkeeper, so many times we end up judging people where it's not necessary at all. But Swami says the fourth category of people are the, you know, the most irrational. At the same time, I think they're doing more harm to themselves also, as we're going to see. But the response to this categorization that Swami gives is very interesting from Hislop's side. And I'm sure when we read out that, a lot of people will feel the same thing, right?
But before that, you know, Prem, I was just reminded when we read about gratitude, many times Swami has emphasized on gratitude. In fact, when he came to the Radio Sai studio also, he emphasized so much on how it is important that we must have gratitude. And he mentioned, you know, he mentions the name of the person. He says that towards Srinivas, you must have gratitude because he is the one who has done all this for you, to Gopal. Gopal Srinivasan, he has built the studio. You must express your gratitude. And at that point in time when somebody says, yes, Swami, we are grateful to you, Swami says, who? To whom? Not to me. To him. Because he has done it. All said and done. Even if it is Swami's will, this person has been the instrument to do this. So therefore, you have to express your gratitude to him. And I came across this discourse, and this is just a sample, because in multiple discourses, Swami has said this. In the 2001 Ganesh Chaturthi discourse, Swami says that it is because of gratitude that you are able to see. In another discourse, Swami says that the Surya Namaskar that we do, that in the Surya Namaskar, there are certain mantras to be chanted. One of them, praises the sun god as the one who rewards gratitude and one who punishes ingratitude.
No.
Swami says that also in another discourse, I don't know which one. But in the Ganesh Chaturthi discourse, Swami says that the sun will take away the power of light from your eyes, meaning you will get blind if you don't show gratitude. And Swami goes on to even make the statement that anybody suffering from eye problems have had a history, definitely, you know, in brackets, it's not just this birth, across births, history of ingratitude. That is why the eyesight is affected. That's what Swami says. And, my attention towards this aspect, wherein if you're ungrateful, something happens to your eye, was drawn in very strange circumstances. You know, about a decade before, I happened to meet one of my favorite teachers, Dr. Sailesh Srivastava. Dr. Sailesh, yeah, he is a physics teacher in the school. He had some kind of boils over his left eye. And I asked him, what happened, sir? He said, this is because of ingratitude. I was like shocked. I asked him, what happened? And I don't want to go into that detailed story now, because it's a very, very long story. It is very well captured in his book, which is a mesmerizing book to read. I would recommend everyone to read it. It's called Swami, Guruji and I. It's in two parts, and it's available in our bookstore here. But in the second part of the book, he writes in elaborate detail about all this. But he told me that it is because of ingratitude. And I was shocked. What is it about ingratitude? That is when he told me, see, this is what it is. And he showed me Swami's discourse, where Swami says that you get eye problems if you have ingratitude. I said, sir, it just looks like some boils and it's not even affecting the eye. He said, no. This is herpes zoster. And herpes is a very dangerous kind of condition. It can lead to blindness as well. And he said that he was suffering from this for almost 10 days, 11 days, a month had passed, and it was not getting well. So finally he went to the general hospital. They immediately diagnosed it as herpes. And they told him, good that you have come, because if you come beyond 48 hours, no medication will work fine on this. And he says, inwardly I realized that it's not going to be of any use now then, because 48 hours are long past. But they said that even normal antibiotics won't work. There's only one medicine called acyclovir. That acyclovir was prescribed to him, and he had to take it every 2 hours, which means in the middle of the night he had to get up and all that he had to do. So he went back. He said, you know, he told all the teachers in the hostel, and this was the time he told me also. I was also like, oh God, sir, this is something. But he seemed very calm. He seemed very fine. And the reason for that was again amazing. He said, see, though this is all medical thing, this is because of this ingratitude. I've realized it and I'm correcting it. It will be fine. I was really wondering how it will be fine, because I felt that he has neglected it for so long. It's not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. To cut the long story short, within a month's time, it was all fine. In fact, if you read about herpes, they say that even if you are able to catch it in the early stage, when it comes around the eye especially, and you treat it and get rid of it, it will leave behind some terrible scars. Now if you look at Silasa, there's nothing like that. And in his book, he has beautifully explained what was the incident of ingratitude and how he actually repented and how he made up for it. All that is a very, very long story, though almost half of the book is about that only. So I will not go into that now, but you know, that really woke me to the fact, to the truth that, you know, we may say that whatever Swami says is Vedavakya, Swami's word is the scripture and all that, but practically, you know, we just think that, this Swami said this. For me, this was one instance where it hit me that, you know, every sentence that Swami says has so much meaning, and here is a practical proof. Medically, it is impossible, but he got it cured because he said this happened because of ingratitude. The moment I located that ingratitude and I corrected it, I started expressing my gratitude and set it right, it went off. He got cured of herpes zoster in 2008-2009. It's phenomenal, and you know, it really struck deep in my heart that irrespective of what happens, you know, as you said, it doesn't depend on how good or how bad the other person is. If the other person has done any help, anything good to you, the least you can do is show gratitude for it. And I mean, that's not the least you can do. The least you can do is not show ingratitude towards it, at least, as Swami says. Because ingratitude is a sin. And again, as Swami says in multiple discourses, such kind of ingratitude leads to problems of the eye, the worst being you losing sight. The sun god takes away the power of light from your eyes. That is what Swami says.
I think we've, even in earlier discourses, we have discussed about gratitude. But of course, that example was very, very graphic and very telling. There's one thing, I'm not sure of the reference where this comes, but Swami has mentioned this in a few places where Swami speaks about gratitude and the attitude of dutifulness being the, you know, pillars of Indian culture. And Swami would say that you cannot have a spiritual Indian traditional life if you do not have these two ideas, of gratitude and of, you know, thinking that what is my duty towards society in each of your relationships, in each of your roles that you play in your life. You know, a duty-centric life preferred over a rights-centric life in that sense.
Is it by chance Kritagnyata and Kartavya Palana?
I don't know exactly the terminology, but Swami would say this, both gratitude and the idea that, you know,
duty.
Asking what is your duty and then performing it. And Swami actually explains that, you know, when you constantly acknowledge the people that who have helped you get where you are. And Swami would say this, you know, even if you're a doctor, you have to be grateful to society, because without society, you cannot be a doctor. You know, even if you're a teacher, without students, you cannot be a teacher. If you're a businessman, without people buying your products, you cannot be a businessman. So for everything, there is a certain amount of gratitude which comes with that. And, you know, in the modern way, the way we look at it, we always look at ourselves as self-made. You know, I worked hard, I studied hard, I got these degrees, and I worked hard and built my company, and so I am here today. But the moment you start showing gratitude, at least as a mental attitude, you know, expression of gratitude comes later. Because even to Swami's students, Swami would say that you should have the gratitude, but I don't want anything in form for that. I don't want you to come and give me anything in money or anything like that. But that gratitude should always be there. So when you have that gratitude, that sense that I am today because of what my parents did, I am today because of what my teachers did, Swami says the feeling of doership actually reduces. When you have a certain success at the age of 40 or 50, you will be able to look at that and say that so many people are responsible for this, so you do not claim doership over what you have achieved. And that becomes, you know, one of the most important traits for a spiritual life. Giving up doership is the whole idea of the entire journey. So in that sense, Swami says the developing of this attitude of gratitude is very, very important. It's not merely a cultural a sign of a cultured person. You know, somebody who shows a lot of gratitude is suddenly a more cultured, comes from a good family and all of that. But a spiritual trait, it becomes a trait which is very, very essential for the spiritual journey. And I think that's why Swami is saying that, you know, just anybody has to be grateful. And the statement that Swami said is, if you cannot be grateful for those who have physically done something good for you, somebody has come and given you money at the time when you needed it, or someone who has come and helped you when you were physically ill, if you cannot show gratitude to people, and especially parents, there are people who have physically, in a manner that you can observe, have done, helped you. How will you be able to show gratitude to God, who for most part is invisible and he's been helping you?
Absolutely. And, you know, when also Swami says about these four classes of people, it becomes very clear that in the world there's nothing as such as good and bad. Depending on which class of person you are, you perceive the world. If you're in the first class, you see everything as good. If you're in the second class, you see watertight compartments that these are good, these are bad. If you're in the third class, you don't see good or bad at all because it's all neutral. If you're in the fourth class, you see everything as bad. It brings to mind what Swami would say, that there's nothing wrong in the srishti. It's all in the drishti. There's no problem in the creation. It's all in your vision that is there. And I was also reminded of this thing that we chant in the Purusha Suktam. We say, Chandrama Manaso Jataha Chaksho Suryo Ajayata.
Right.
There also, the presiding deity of the eye is the sun. I just thought it would be relevant to mention that here, because Swami says that the act of ingratitude leads to sun taking away power of the eyes. Indeed, the sun is the presiding deity of the eye. Going ahead with the conversation, Hislop now says, there must be just a few people in this fourth class, meaning the class whom, for whom everything and everyone is evil, not that class. So Hislop says, there must be just a few people in this fourth class, perhaps from the lower socio-economic group. And Swami says, on the contrary, it is the largest class of all, and it is not a special characteristic of poor people. The poorest peasants often rely on our Indian traditions of thousands of years past, and they behave very cautiously. They fear to commit a sin. Poor people who have moved near the cities lose contact with their hereditary background and live in a world which they see as wholly bad. Likewise, the so-called educated middle class, who are half educated and half ignorant, do not fear sin, nor do they believe there is a God, and they become sinful, corrupt, immoral, greedy, hateful, and so on. And that is their world. So when Hislop tries to generalize, saying that people who are not able to see anything good and see everything as evil and bad, they are usually from the lower strata, lower socio-economic group, Swami immediately says, no, that is not the case. And Swami says, first of all, let me make it clear that majority are like this. Majority see only evil and bad. And he says, but in that, the lower socio-economic group, especially in India, they are not like this. They are the ones who rely more on traditions, have belief in God, and therefore they have fear of sin. And you know, even if we look at it in general thing, we find this true. Today in India, you know, they speak of an economic slowdown. Things are not, the economy is going down, it is not booming, all this they speak about. And one of the major problems is a large number of loans that are turning into NPAs, which are turning into bad debts. You just have to write them off. And because a large number of loans are turning into NPAs, there is not much money left with lending, left with the lenders to lend. Mm-hmm. And very few loans are there which are, you know, which are receiving payments regularly. But if you look at all the major banks and financial institutions in India, they are now targeting actually the some of the lowest socioeconomic groups only. Because it's a very well-known, well-documented fact that these are the people who are the most prompt in their payments, who would rather commit suicide rather than, you know, renege on a loan or let a loan go bad. Because it's a matter of self-esteem, self-respect. Even in villages, if you go to tiny villages which have been left untouched by these modern, ugly modernization, I would say, it is considered as an insult to be indebted. To be debt-free is considered to be a matter of great pride. Whereas with the credit card culture in some of our, in quotes, advanced cultures, you are considered foolish if you don't live on credit. In fact, credit is a way of life. In fact, in some places, they don't even accept debit cards. They don't even know what is the meaning of a debit card. Card means only credit card. So, it's a really a definitely a misnomer or misconception that Hislop has that the lower socio-economic group is like this, because Swami says no, they are the ones in fact who have more fear of sin, who have more respect and reverence towards tradition and God, and culture is there in them. That is why I think Swami, and not just Swami, even great leaders like Mahatma Gandhi said that India lives in her villages. That is where the culture is alive and vibrant, and you know, it is for these people. In fact, I feel it's the goodness of these people that have made India blessed with avatars like our Bhagwan.
I think this one paragraph Swami is like literally defined the status of the society today. You know, Swami speaks about the lower class, the middle class, and everything. And a good look at this, and of course, what Swami says a little later, gives an idea of what Swami says when he says lower class, middle class. Hmm. You know, it is we who look at it as economic background, right? We say that poor people means the lower class, the middle class are the people who are the working class or trying to get into the higher class, and then the upper class. But the way Swami looks at it is completely different. Swami is looking at it from the point of being cultured, first of all, right? And yes, money is an important thing, but Swami is saying that you'll find a lot of people in the lower class who are actually very, very satisfied. In fact, we were talking about gratitude, we were talking about that leading to the way you look at the world. Clearly, if you see, there are a lot of people in the lower class in the lower socio-economic class, who will have much more gratitude in life than the people in the middle and the upper classes. The middle and the upper classes, a lot of us feel entitled. Mm-hmm. We feel that we pay the taxes. You know, we deserve this. But you will find that in the lower classes, they are more grateful. The way they will respect you if you do anything good for them will be completely different. That idea of gratitude is more seen in that lower class, for one. That is one thing which you can see. But the other thing is it's the feeling of being treated unfairly or not having enough in life. That is actually universal. It can be in any of these classes. It is not specific only to the lower class. As you know, if you look at one of these famous characters in the epics, Karna. Karna is one who actually starts off in the lower class and he feels that he is being treated unfairly. Right? And that kind of defines his character. He feels that I have talent, but I'm not being given the opportunity. Mm. You know, I'm so much better than all the other princes, but still I'm not getting the prominence. The saddest thing is, you know, he grows from being somebody who is in the lowest class, who is actually brought up as a son of a charioteer, to being the king of a so small kingdom. But he never gives up that feeling that he is being treated unfairly. So which means once that feeling grips your heart, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. That always continues, and you have to get rid of that. And you can see that, you know, not for once he stops and thinks, oh, how far have I come? The world has been so fair to me in that sense, or has been so good to me. There are so many people who are talented who probably would not have reached the place where I've reached. So never he has the feeling of gratitude actually for what he has become, but he is always catching that bitterness. And I think that's probably the one quality of Karna which kind of spoiled his peace of mind. For everybody else, he was a good man. You know, he did a lot of charity. He was a very noble person and all of that, apart from his bad company. But personally, he lived a miserable life because he never got over this feeling that he was being treated unfairly or he did not get his due. And Swami is saying that that is not a fiefdom of the people who are poor. And you can really see that there are a lot of people who have less means and they are absolutely happy and they find contentment in that life. And as so rightly Swami says, it's the people who move out of the village and who are now are able to see what a better life looks like. The feeling of jealousy starts coming in, and that's when the contentment goes away, and then all the problem starts. You try hard, you work hard, try to reach that life, and when that doesn't happen, you try to manipulate your way into getting there. And when life treats you unfairly, you become bitter, and all of that starts only when, you know, somebody strikes at your contentment.
It reminds me of a story we had done a video on called the 99 Club. It's all about that, you know. The story goes that there's a very rich person who looks at a very poor person and asks his friend, how is it that this person, not having anything that I have, is still so contentment and happy and peaceful? And the friend says, that's because he's not part of the 99 Club. He says, what do you mean by 99 Club? He says, I'll tell you. Take a pot, put 99 gold coins and keep it near his home. don't put 100, put 99. And the friend is intrigued, but he does as told. And the next day, this poor person, financially poor person, but otherwise very rich and contented person, sees this pot with gold coins. He's thrilled, obviously. And the thrill lasts only for a little while, because he soon starts counting the coins and he sees there are only 99. Yeah, how can there be 99? I think there should be 100. He counts it over and over and over again, and every time he counts, he sees there's only 99. Now there's a feeling of dissatisfaction. A dissatisfaction that wasn't there in his heart when he had not even a single coin. He says, no, I must have 100, because, you know, 100 gold coins sounds awesome, it feels awesome, and therefore starts his quest in life to make that 100th gold coin. For that, he starts working harder and harder, you know, he becomes, because as his standard of, you know, when the moment you start earning more, that's what I think anybody who is in their 40s and 50s will realize, that you start off working with a very small salary and you just wish that if I get 50% more, my life is set. 10 years down the line, you've got 200% more and yet you're not satisfied, because as your income starts increasing, your living lifestyle, the way you spend also starts increasing.
I think you go from the 99 club to the 999 club.
To the 9999
club.
Yes. You keep going higher and higher and you want more and more, and that's it. At the end of it, you realize that you have lost all that you had in the pursuit of, and in the pursuit of this thing, that one coin that you felt you wanted. And this has this cycle of how a desire sets in and drives away all your contentment, peace, has been shown in multiple ways. You know, I remember reading even a Jataka tale. Jataka tales, I think they are Buddhist tales based on animals. It says that there is this monkey that comes across a packet of peanuts. And it's very, very thrilled that it found this, and it picks up that peanuts, and the minute people notice it, they come to chase it. So it picks up some peanuts in the hand and holds the packet in the other hand, runs away. But in the process of running, two peanuts drop off. And now this monkey is worried where these two peanuts went. And it keeps searching for this peanut, two peanuts, all through the tree, everywhere. At the end of it, it doesn't find the two peanuts, and then it looks that it had not, its attention was off the packet, and in the process of searching for these two peanuts, the packet has emptied itself and it has lost all the peanuts. That's all is this Jataka tale, but I think it again magnifies the same thing, that instead of being grateful for what you have, if you are on the lookout for what you don't have and you are constantly complaining of what you don't have, you lose even whatever little that you have, and life only goes from miserable to more miserable.
And Swami concludes that paragraph where he says that, you know, it all depends on the way you're brought up, whether are you brought up with that fear of sin, whether you're brought up with that feeling that, you know, as Swami would say, love for God and fear of sin, deva priti papa bhiti. I think that's also a hint to all of us, whether you are rich, whether you are poor. I think that goes up and down. Swami never says that don't work hard, don't earn a good living, don't lead a good life. I think that's a different thing. As Swami would say, that should not define your life's progress. As Swami would say many, many times, you know, there's a lifestyle is different, but the quality of life is completely different. The quality of life, you should ensure that you have all of these qualities firmly established. Are you grateful? However poor you are, however rich you are you grateful? In fact, last week we were talking about Helen Keller, that somebody who is, in our eyes, so deprived can feel so grateful. Right, so it's you don't have to have the 100th gold coin to be grateful. 99 gold coins are more than enough to be grateful. I think that if we are able to remember that attitude gets firmly planted, and then it doesn't matter. One day you're rich, the next day everything goes, but you'll be still grateful for what you have.
Just inspired with this quote, I mean, self-made now, that quality of life depends on the qualities we have in life. And right. I think in that, gratitude will definitely be one of the foremost qualities, because that's what Swami is saying. It depends on the qualities that you have. In fact, before we take a break, I think we'll just read the next two statements, because it's related, where Hislop says, as Swami says it, I recollect that in the West, those who are corrupt are from the educated middle class, who gain positions of wealth, authority and power. But many workers are also corrupt in their lives and relationships. But in America, I do not think the same behavior and attitude is typical of the upper class. And Swami says, if by upper class you mean those who have a tradition and who are correctly trained by their parents, then the same would be true even of a large number of farmers living in the Indian village.
Really? No matter, beautiful.
He makes it very clear what is upper class. Don't think of this as upper class, because if at all Hislop was referring to the economically very forward and the ultra rich as the upper class, I think this conversation is happening in the 60s and 70s. If he had lived till now, he would have seen how some of the most biggest scams and inhuman things have happened in the economically upper class. So that's why Swami again makes it very clear that yes, upper class don't have it. If by upper you are meaning those who have been correctly trained by parents and who have a tradition. I think Swami is so beautifully redefined, or not actually redefined, actually given us a correct definition of these words. In fact, even when people would say Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, Swami would say this is not an institute for higher earning. He would make it very clear that the education you receive here is not for a living but for life. And he would emphasize that higher meant Atma Vidya, getting the higher Vidya. It will give that learning. That is the higher learning that this institute is supposed to give you, and that is why it's called Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. So in the same way Swami says, like how he redefined higher there, he redefines what is upper and says upper is those who have been brought up in the proper traditions and those who have been correctly trained by their parents.
And clearly saying that, you know, those who move from that lower class to the middle class to the higher class, it's not to be said that those who are poorer who become rich seem to be more corrupt. It's not even in that sense. It clearly is that those who have not sublimated their emotions, sublimated their qualities and go higher up, I mean, the scale of your corruption only becomes larger, right? You know,
correct.
from being a thief who was stealing 10 rupees and 20 rupees, you become really rich, you start stealing 10 crores and 20 crores. I think that's the typical story of a lot of politicians in our country. But that's what Swami is saying, that if you have culture, then it doesn't matter whether you're the richest or the poorest, you will still lead a very good life, and plenty of examples. In fact, well, you know, we can't help but recollect, one just has to go and look at some of these Padma awardees in the past 3 or 4 years. You know, the Padma Shris and Padma Bhushans which are being awarded. I think the government is taking a lot of pains to identify some people who are doing phenomenal work. And, you know, people who are from very, very poor economic backgrounds or from very well-educated middle class. But the kind of work they're doing is phenomenal, right? It's nothing like you need money to do good work, or you have to be very, if you're very poor, then you have no scope for corruption. There's nothing like that. The very poor have shown some kind of a large-heartedness that most of us with so much money don't have. At the same time, people with a lot of money also have shown some kind of
cheapness,
which, you know, the poor cannot in any day match.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, and on the other side of the break, resume this conversation, because the conversation also, there's a total change in the theme. It comes with a question from a visitor. All that after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. We continue with the conversation. A visitor now asks Swami, Swami, Mr. X wishes to make a film about the so-called lost years of Jesus. He has much experience in making films and is a Sai devotee. And Swami replies, Jesus realized that he was Christ in his 25th year. For 8 years following his 16th birthday, he traveled in India, Tibet, Iran and Russia. He was variously regarded as a beggar or as a sannyasi. Jesus had no money. His parents were very poor and practically abandoned him at an early age. So, Swami says that it was in the 25th year he became the Christ. The Christ biblically translates into the anointed one. So it's like, I think, how we say Buddha got Nirvana or he became enlightened. This is the time when Jesus became the Christ. Jesus was just a aspirant. Swami also, you know, defines his journey. He says it started off with him being the messenger of God. Then he said that he is the son of God before finally saying that I and my father are one. So the beginning of that journey where he became the messenger of the God, messenger of God, Swami says, was in his 25th year. So that is what Swami replies. I don't know exactly whether Swami said, yes, go ahead and make the film or not.
I think the reference must be to Richard Bach, the filmmaker who has made a lot of beautiful movies on Swami in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just have an article which is from a book which was authored by Janet Bach,
his wife,
and compiled together. I think the book's name is The Jesus Mystery of Lost Years and Unknown Travels.
I also remember seeing a Richard Bach documentary on the same theme, The Lost Years of Jesus.
Okay, so he must have gone forward and made a thing, because I think one of the 70s or some one of the Shivratris, I think Swami extensively spoke about that.
Mm.
I think 78, not 70s. So it's a compilation of whatever Swami had said during those discourses. So I think he must have finally gone and did the movie.
Mm.
Swami doesn't say no here, I think. Right?
And I was just thinking, today I think Christianity is possibly one of the richest religions in the world. To know that the founder had, Swami says, he was variously regarded by people as a beggar or a sannyasi. I think the way Swami chooses the words are so perfect and beautiful. He doesn't say that he was a beggar and sannyasi. Swami says this is how people regarded him. So he had no money and yet it's amazing that he traveled India, Iran, Russia, Tibet. Wow, that's phenomenal. The theme again changes after this, because now Hislop gets back into the questioning mode and he asks, Swami, what is the art of looking whereby one may see the Lord even in unpleasant and disagreeable persons? This seems like a logical question to come now after all that we have discussed on gratitude and how, irrespective of how a person is, we should not get into judging him or her, but should definitely express gratitude. Ingratitude is a sin, all this. Then he's asking, so how do I see God in a person irrespective of how unpleasant or disagreeable he or she is? And Swami says, even in persons of an unpleasant nature, be aware that the Lord is in the heart, even of that person. Have that aspect in mind and treat that person from that viewpoint to the best of your ability. In time, the person will respond and nature will change, and his nature will change. One sees people as good or bad because he does not see the person in full, but only one side. So Swami's response is, it's most important to drive in that awareness within you. Be aware that Swami is there in that person. And then, to the best of your ability, try to, you know, treat that person with that viewpoint. That is what Swami says.
I think it's a very, very beautiful, at the same time, practical answer that Swami is giving. You know, many times when you look at it, I think it's all of us need this advice, and all of us are in a position or have been in a position where we're trying to interact with somebody. And having come to Swami, you know that this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to see Swami in everyone. So, you know, any number of times Swami has said that your devotion is not complete unless you see Swami in Swami, you worship him, but you start seeing the same Swami in everybody around. And I don't think any of our listeners need to be told it's difficult. It's not easy. But Swami also acknowledges that, and that's why he says that make it a part of your awareness that when you're interacting with somebody, can you remind yourself that however that person might come across to you, there is Swami in him or in that, in her. That remind yourself.
Remembrance.
Swami says that awareness is important. And then try to the best of your ability. You know, you don't have to overdo it. Yes, we all are emotion driven. I think that's the status we are in right now. We are driven by what we hear, what we see, and what is obvious in front of us. And we are trying to turn it around and lead a life by what we believe in and rather than what we see. And that's the change we're trying to do, and that's not going to be easy. Just like how initially Swami said, you know, the most practical way to live life is something which is bad, something which is right. From there, if you have to really go to that state where you say that everything that happens has a reason and it's good, then you're trying to go to a state where you're trying to go beyond what meets your eye. And that needs a little bit of training. It needs, you know, we don't realize many, many things that we do in life today have gone through that training in this one. You know, how we judge things, how we interact with objects from what we were doing as infants and children. The way we interact right now is completely different. You know, the way we interact with fire. You know, we know that fire is a utility right now. We don't fear it. At the same time, somebody who looks at a body of water before learning swimming and after learning swimming is completely different. So you kind of acquire the way you look at that object differently. And I think that requires training, that requires conscious effort. That's what Swami is saying. That yes, right now it's not possible for you to see Swami in that person. But first of all, want to do that and then try with your awareness and try to your best ability and slowly things will change.
And I think to develop that that kind of view, that kind of perspective, practically what we can try is, you know, to put ourselves in others' shoes. I remember a funny quotation which says, if you are angry with a person, put yourself in his or her shoes and walk for a mile. And says, that way you'll understand what's biting them and you'll have a pair of shoes for yourself. So, anyway, but the thing is, we often look at everything from only our perspective. I was reading an article in our website. It's written by a certain Miss Anisha Bordoloi. Mm-hmm. She writes about her grandmother. It's a beautiful episode. She writes that her grandmother, when she turned 90, she called all her children. So her, the author's father also was there. And she called everyone and said, yeah, these are all what is mine, what is left of me. So I have different things. What are the things that you want? So everybody could claim part of her property, her stuff. So the author's father just said that, all the diaries that you write, I want those diaries. So apparently till the grandmother breathed her last, she kept writing her diaries. So the grandmother agreed, and that's how, after she ultimately passed away, stacks and stacks of diaries came to their home. So they would enjoy reading, and the author writes that it was an absolute delight to go through the wisdom that was enshrined in those pages. And one particular episode that struck her a lot was, so this grandmother was very, very helpful. Her husband had left behind quite a sum of money, and she was very generous, very compassionate, very kind. And the family appreciated her large heart. But they always had problem with one particular lady who was from a lower socioeconomic class, but would come to the grandmother only when she had any trouble or any kind of problem, so that, you know, the granny would give her money and help her. The granny would not only give her money and help her, would call her in, make her sit, feed her something, okay? And they write that in spite of all that, this lady did not show even the slightest bit of gratitude, because when things would get better, she would not speak nicely, she would not even come to see. It would be, she would speak rudely with other members of the family. I mean, don't you have that much that it's my grandmother who's helping you? You better talk to me with respect, dignity, none of that. So they kept wondering, what is it that makes this grandmother keep helping her? Again, after sometimes that lady comes back and again the granny helps. So they could not change the granny, nor could they change this lady. They left it at that. And she says that when they were going through the diary, there was one long article written by the grandmother in her diary saying that people always say that they wonder why they are always confused as to why I'm helping this lady. They don't understand that this lady is very lonely. She has nobody in her life. That is the reason, irrespective of how everyone in the house is treating her, means with suspicion, with definitely a kind of disgust. Only the granny is treating her nicely. In spite of all that, she keeps coming back here because it's obvious that she has nowhere to go to. You know, if I stop, it's very easy for me to just shoo her away in 5 minutes. But if I do that, she'll become totally lonely. She'll have nobody in the world for herself. What will happen to her? So, I can't do this. If she feels that I'm the only friend in the world, be it so, I will be like that. And the author writes that reading that brought tears in all our eyes. And reading this, I realize that every time when we see, we are nice to people who are nice to us. Because the focus is always us. It's only from my own perspective, it's from my shoes that I judge everyone. Once if I'm able to get into the other person's shoes, possibly my perspective, the way I treat, everything will change so much. And she writes that in that same diary, the granny had written that all this inspiration for what she is in life, she drew from a statement that she heard from Swami when she first came to Swami. God knows when, it was 60s or 70s. And that statement is so beautiful, where Swami says, you know, in that statement Swami says, do not judge others to decide whether they deserve your service. Find out whether they are distressed. That is sufficient credentials. Do not examine how they behave towards others either, for they can certainly be transformed by love. Service should be for you a sacred vow, a sadhana, a spiritual path. It is the very breath. It can end only when the breath takes leave of you. And with tears of joy, gratitude and contentment, the author concludes the article saying, I think my grandmother followed this to the letter, to the spirit. Because that spirit of service was her life breath till her physical life breath actually left her.
Amazing. And I think I recall reading that article. It's a very, very beautiful article. In fact, written, the person you're referring to is Bodulaiser's mother. Bodulaiser is, you know, is an English professor in Swami's university for many, many years. From Assam. I think he comes from a very, very reputed family in Assam. I think they've been in very, very important positions from the formation of the state and all of that. But what a beautiful account. And it just shows that every statement of Swami takes a lifetime to really find fulfillment. And really, you know, you could read one line of this, but when you speak of a person like that, you know that how any command of Swami and any message of Swami can be taken, an entire life can be lived on the basis of that, and you can find fulfillment. You know, it's not just about segregating Swami's message and saying that this suits me, I'll follow this. If you really deeply and honestly follow even one statement of Swami, you will find that
all of this,
everything else automatically comes, and you find life of fulfillment. And in this case, that's what Swami is saying, that, you know, you should want that. It is difficult. It is not easy for you to not judge a person and try to help. As you rightly said, you know, all the time our focus is ourselves. Right? And to change this nature and to turn that focus away to actually the Swami in each one, right? Continue to keep the focus on yourself in the sense that Swami is within you. As Swami would say, that now you don't please the ego, but you please the indweller. And now when you start looking for the same indweller in everyone, it's a complete paradigm shift in the way you're going to lead your life. So it's not going to be easy. I think so. The first acknowledgement is it's not easy. It's not something that you've been doing all your life. It's got to be different. And that conscious effort that I was, I might get the details wrong, but I was listening to a talk by one of the Sevadal members. For him, he would say that this was one of the most important instructions that Swami would give. Try to see Swami in whoever you interact with. And he would say that I've done experiments with this and it has changed the way I look at people. And as Swami is saying here, you know, the last statement that Swami made here, in time, that person will respond. It's not only your attitude towards that person and your tolerance levels will go up. You will find a difference in that person's attitude also. And this person is saying that, you know, I've tried this out in business. I've tried this out in the people who work under me. I've tried this out with friends. If you really honestly and consciously make this effort, you will find that the other person responds to that. There will be a change of behavior from the other person. So he was telling this, you know, there was another Sevadal member who came and told him, you know, there is this person in his village. They had some fight and that fight became very bitter. And now they are in a stage where they just look at each other and, you know, they can't stand each other. The other person would kind of, you know, in disgust, spit on the road the moment he sees him to show that, you know, I'm disgusted with you or something like that. And even the slightest thing could become a fight or argument or something. So this person is telling, see, I feel very uncomfortable with this thing. Because I know Swami doesn't like it, that Swami doesn't want us to have this sort of a negative relationship with anyone. But I don't know what to do. That person is not even, I don't think he will even sit down and talk with me if I want to. So how do I set right this, you know, unpleasant interaction with this particular individual? So this person told, you know, this is the technique that Swami says, you have to see Swami in everyone. So he says, it's impossible. You know, the moment I see him, he makes a frown on his face and probably uses foul words and he spits away like this. How can I see Swami in a person who does these things which are so contrary to our image of Swami? Mm-hmm. Right? So he said, no, it's not easy, but you make the effort. The next time you look at that person, you say that, Swami, I'm going to interact with you who's inside and not with this person. Right? You make a deal with Swami like that and then you go in front of that person. And he said, you will find a change. Right? And I think this person does start trying to do that and all of that. And somehow he never confronts that person. He mentally tries to think that, you know, that, you know, I should see Swami in that person, I should see Swami in that person. And at one point he's walking down the road and he finds the other person coming from the other side. So he says, Swami, today is the test. Right? I am going to look at the person, I'm going to look at you who's inside that person, and now I want you to respond from inside. Right? Prove to me that this technique works. So he's walking and he's very tensed what is going to be the response from the other person. And I think inadvertently he smiles at the other person, right? And that person walks up to him and he tells him, don't go this way. They're doing some repair there and something is falling from, you know, some dirt is falling from the other side or something. So don't go that way. Take another route. Okay, and pats him on the back and goes. So this person was actually, I think he was riding a cycle or a bike or something like that. He says that he parked the bike on the side. He sat down there and he cried for 5 minutes. He said, can there be a better proof? You know, here is Swami telling that do this, this works. And Swami is ever ready to come and, you know, show you that it works, give you that encouragement, give you that enthusiasm which is required, right? And I think that's a beautiful thing that Swami is saying, that in that one sentence, Swami is saying, make a conscious effort, just keep it in your memory that you have to see Swami in that person and do as much as you can. It's not like you have to go from zero to one. Do as much as you can and you will find the other person also responding.
That's the beautiful thing about Swami. No? He never emphasizes on achieving it. He's always about put in your effort. I think that is why it is very encouraging for us, because all I need to know is, even if I'm not succeeding, if I'm putting effort, it's enough for Swami. Swami, you know, again, the conversation continues actually. He says, suppose a mother is 6 feet tall and her young child could not yet walk, but can only sit on the floor. Will that mother say, I am 6 feet tall, when I stand erect, I will not bend myself for the sake of the child? Or does she bend down to the child because of her love for the child? As another example, there may be a person with many big degrees who teaches small children. Will he refuse to help the children because he knows so much? The children must start to learn by being drilled in the ABCs. They must learn at their level. Swami is clearly saying that if you are the bigger person, it doesn't mean that you won't. The bigger person is the one who is ready to come down to this lower level. I mean, if you say that there is a person who is very uncultured, who is at a lower level of spiritual evolution possibly, that's why he or she speaks badly, retorts badly, doesn't treat anybody nicely, they are prone to jealousy, envy, anger and all this. Are you different from that person? Are you the bigger person? Because Swami says the mother is very tall. She is the bigger person. And that's why when the child refuses to go, she bends down and picks. That is a physical bigness. Then even in terms of knowledge, Swami says that there is a person who is very wise, who's earned many degrees. But when it comes to a child, he won't show off the higher degrees. He will teach ABC. it's always the bigger person who comes down to the level of the smaller person. In the same way, if you say that spiritually somebody is small, somebody is prone to all these arshad vargas and these negative things, how are you different from the other person? If you are different, if you feel you are the better person, the bigger person, then you have to do this. I mean, both ways, Swami says the same thing, and I think that is definitely a motivation for us.
Right, and I think it's also, Swami is saying that you do this every day in life. It's not like something that is out of the ordinary in that sense that, but we don't see it that way. You know, we look at the other person as being, I'm right and that person is wrong, or that person is unpleasant and I'm the one who's right, as you're saying. But in life, we always see that there's somebody who needs help, we help that person. I always think of it this way. The way we show compassion to physical disability, we don't show compassion to emotional disability.
And spiritual disability.
And spiritual disability. You know, the moment we see somebody who's physically disabled, somebody who's on crutches, somebody who's on wheelchair, we automatically are ready to be more patient, right?
Mm.
You know, you're getting into a train or a bus and you find somebody who's very old or infirm or disabled.
You allow them to go forward.
You allow them to take as much time as they want, and you probably are even ready to lift luggage for them. But you find somebody who is
impatient,
or, you know, who's probably, you know, disturbed and stressed out, and they might be having something or the other. And if somebody like that comes, the way we treat them is completely different, because we do not acknowledge spiritual and emotional disability as much as we acknowledge physical disability. So it's just that, as we were saying, it is easy to react to what you see in front of you. We are trying to go to that state where we are trying to build our responses to the unseen. So that will take that conscious effort.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take another quick little break, and on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation.
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना साई मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना साई दर्शन की प्यासी अखिया तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे लागे ना तेरे बिना रे छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले नयन कमल मन मोहक मादक रंजित है अधरा रे तेरी छवीयति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले इस छवि को हम मन में भर कर तेरे गुण को गाए तेरे गुण को गाए मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना तेरे बिना जग माया काए बंधन टूट न पाए तेरे बिना जग माया काए बंधन टूट न पाए जीवन नैया पग पग डोले जीवन मिया पग पग डोले तू ही पार लगाए तेरी शरण में ले के प्रभु तू कृपा शांति बरसाए कृपा शांति बरसाए मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे तेरे दर्शन के प्यासे अखियां तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स वील कंटिन्यू विद द कन्वर्सेशन We have got a few more minutes, so maybe a little more part we can cover. Hislop now continues with where he had left off before. I mean, where we had left off before. That is, he asks, how do you see God even in unpleasant people? Hislop says, I see the body. How does one see God himself? Not just the body. Swami says, in order to see the moon, does one need a torch? It is by the light of the moon that one sees the moon. In like fashion, if one wishes to see God, it is by love, which is the light of God, that one may see him. Then Hislop continues, Swami says that like the blind man who has no eyes to see, we are likewise blind and unable to see our own divinity. With what vision does one see one's own divinity? And Swami replies, a blind man cannot see his body. You can because you have eyes. But you have no eyes to see your spiritual body. You have a spiritual body that is omnipresent. That body can be seen with the spiritual eye. Would Swami describe the spiritual eye? Oh yes, the spiritual eye is God. Attain him and the spiritual eye will open. What does Swami mean when he says to look within oneself? What is meant by that look? Looking within does not mean looking into the body of flesh and bones. It means transcending the senses as in deep meditation. So this is the conversation where Swami makes it very clear that to see God, just like you to see the moon, you need the light of the moon. To see the sun, you need the light of the sun. To see God, you need light of God. And Swami says that light of God is love. So without love, you can't expect to see God in yourself, in others, anywhere.
Right, and I think again, version of what we were talking about, is we're talking about looking beyond what, you know, physically you see. As Swami would beautifully say, what you see in the worldly life is called, you know, seeing through your charma chakshu, Swami would say. The word charma in Sanskrit actually means leather. Mm. And so charma chakshu means this eye, which is part of the body, which is made of, you know, tissues. So Swami would say you constantly lead life only seeing through your charma chakshu, but there is something called a jnana chakshu, which is your eye of the wisdom eye. And the whole idea is to shift from this to that. And one of that is, as you know, Hislop himself points out, is looking within. The whole idea of spirituality is actually to look within, as Swami would refer to that as the nivritti marga, right? Pravritti is going outward and nivritti is turning inward. And Swami would say that both is important, not that you have to discard one and should only start looking within. And Swami would, the typical example that Swami would give, very, very simple and very practical, Swami would say you see a mango, right? Before eating the mango, you see, you know, is it ripe? Does it have the right fragrance? Does it have, is it soft? You know,
are there insects in it?
You know, are there insects in it? Or is it rotten and all of that? And Swami said that is pravritti, because you're examining something which is outside you. But how much you should eat that is nivritti, Swami says. Mm. You know, you should have a limit on how much you should eat that. You know, it's not about eat till you drop dead or something like that. It's not in that sense. But you should know what are your limits. So Swami would say life is like that. You constantly bridge both of this, what you see outside and what is within.
You see, when we think of happiness, I mean, whatever we do in our life, it's the root cause for that is because we hope to attain happiness, peace, contentment, joy, any of these from that. And that is why we do whatever we do, be it eating, be it bathing, be it holding a satsang, be it attending a satsang, be it avoiding a satsang, whatever we do, because we think that by doing that, our happiness will increase. But sadly, all our happiness is sense-based. We define happiness by how good the food tastes, how good the sight, the sight before us is, how pleasant the music is. You know, it's all sense-based. It's all external. I think if we start moving towards finding happiness from what is internal-based, what is based on us, then we truly become independent. Swami would often say independence is depending on what is within. So, if we look at it, you know, when I'm seeing a cricket match, I'm not able to enjoy the cricket match because I have expectations. I have expectations that this person should bat well, this person should bowl well, or if not that, ultimately this team should win. In fact, it's a practical experience with my own self I've seen. We have this IPL, which is a premier league for cricket in India. And there are different clubs which play. I am interested in one club or one or two clubs because I like one club, I don't like one club. So when the club that I don't like is playing, I want to see it lose. When a club that I like is playing, I want to see it win. And these tensions get heightened when the club I like is playing against the club I don't like, because I'm desperate to see this win and I'm desperate to see the other club lose. So in all these, I find myself getting either elated or depressed, depending on how it goes based on my expectations. But I've observed that when I see two clubs in which I'm not concerned, I mean, it doesn't bother me whether anybody wins or loses. When I watch that, I actually enjoy the cricket even more. I'm able to appreciate shots irrespective of which batsman of which team is hitting it. I'm able to appreciate the deliveries bowled by the bowler, irrespective of which team they belong to. In fact, I feel I'm able to appreciate cricket when I'm watching teams in which I'm not having interest, either positive or negative. So this is what happens. I feel this is a very, you know, very rough and casual approximation. But when my happiness depends on something that's outside of me, when I have expectations, I'm bound to have disappointments and sorrow. You know, it's not just about cricket. A singer, you know, I expect a singer to sing in a manner. If that singer's voice is not good, I'm disappointed. Hey, this bhajan session itself is a flop, because, you know, that singer didn't sing or that singer didn't come for the bhajan. So, my enjoying the bhajan depends on who is singing it, how well they're singing it, which instruments are being used. You know, in a satsang also, we choose who is, it's almost like an entertainment show. That shows, you know, it's not about the content that is being spoken. Who is speaking it? how they are speaking it. Oh, this satsang is boring. This is very interesting. You know, how when all of our happiness, everything depends on something external, how will I ever find true happiness? I will be like a boat on a sea that keeps getting tossed up and down depending on how the sea is. That's why Swami says, dive deep within, become a submarine. When you go inside, none of the surface ups and downs ever bother you. That's why we have to dive deep within. And Swami is saying, that is what it is. Looking within does not mean looking into the body of flesh and bones. It means transcending the senses. You have to go beyond the senses. Your happiness, your enjoyment, your everything should not depend on what the senses are feeding you. But irrespective of what the senses feed you, you should be in a state of peace and happiness. That is what is meant by going within.
I recall, you know, when we used to take walks in the institute in Vrindavan, you know, we know that there are very, very beautiful gardens in front of the institute building. And even in the quadrangle, there are these wonderful, lovely flowers and, you know, flowering bushes and all of that. We would always enjoy taking walks over there, and really beautiful sight. But if we were to take a walk there with our botany teacher, which would happen, you know, sometimes we would go from the department to the library with him, or we'll have to go to the, you know, the gallery. Anytime we go like that, every now and then he'll stop and say, tell me what plant this is, which file, I don't even know the terminology now, which phylum it belongs to, or which category, what is the
genus,
and all of that. He would ask, and we would not know, but he would tell us that, you know, it belongs to this, and he would say that, see, look at the way the leaf structure is, so which means it falls in this category, or look at the flower, and the symmetry is like this, so it falls into this category. It's the same site. You know, the chemistry students also walk through the same path. Somebody who is probably a poet also walks through the same path. But each one sees it differently because they're seeing it in the light of something else. A botanist is seeing it from the light of the knowledge that he has gathered, from the books that he has read. So similarly, Swami is saying the same thing. You know, if you're going through life, you've constantly seen everything from the light of selfishness, which is actually nothing but, as you were saying, we're constantly looking at it through our senses and to benefit ourselves. You will look at the world in a certain way. But now you are trying to look at the world with the idea that I love Swami and that Swami is in each person and each entity I am trying to interact with. And when you start looking at the world in that light, you will see it completely differently. It's the same flowers, it's the same plants, it's the same colors and all that. But the way you will look at it will be completely different. You know, many times it would happen that if you're a chemist, you would look at the sky and you would probably imagine all the other, you know, the scattering of light which happens, what you've studied in your spectroscopy. And you would, the way you will look at it will be with a completely different thrill, which probably someone who has not studied that science will never be able to understand. Right? In the same manner, a devotee, when he starts looking at the world through his love, as Swami is saying, when you look at the world through the love of God, then you will see it in a totally different light and you will see it in a manner it is meant to be seen.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we will bring this satsang to a close. The conversation continues. It's beautiful, but we will also continue the same the next week. So till then, it is Sairam from all of us, from both of us here. You can, as always, write to us at listener@radiosai.org, your thoughts, your feedback, your comments. And if there are any observations which we can incorporate, we would definitely love to. We will leave you with a song now. On the other side of it, you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Satya Sai Bhagavanu ki enta premayo, Manishini Madhavuni jeya madine swargamu gamacha Madhavude avatarincha Satya Sai Bhagavanu ki enta premayo, Swami ki enta premayo, Satya Sai Bhagavanu ki enta premayo. ಶ್ವರಾಂಬಮುದ್ದು ಬಿಡ್ಡಡೈ ನಡೆಯಾಡೆ ಶ್ರೀನಿವಾಸುಡೈ ஈஸ்வராம்ப முத்து பிட்டடை நடையாடே ஸ்ரீனிவாசுடை ஈஸ்வருடே அவதரிஞ்சை பவித்ர பாரதான எந்த புண்ணியமோ மனதெந்த புண்ணியமோ சத்ய சாயி தர்ஷிம்ப ஜன்ம தன்யமோ மனுஷினி மாதவுனி ஜெயமதினே ஸ்வர்கமுகமாச்ச மாதவுடே அவதரிஞ்ச சத்ய சாயி பகவானுக எந்த பிரேமயோ சுவாமிக்கு எந்த பிரேமயோ சத்ய சாயி பகவானுக்கு எந்த பிரேமயோ மதம் பேர குலம் பேர மச்சராலு தகதன்சு மானவதను బోధించి ప్రేమ మతను స్థాపించా మతం పేర కులం పేర మత్సరాలు తగదంటు మానవతను బోధించి ప్రేమ మతము స్థాపించ సంభవామి యుగే యుగే అని చాటిన రీతిగా సంభవామి యుగే యుగే అని చాటిన జనుల ఆదుకొనగా నీదు సన్నిధి మాకు పెన్నిధి నీదు సన్నిధి మాకు పెన్నిధి నీదు ప్రేమే మాకు ప్రాణము నీదు సన్నిధి మాకు పెన్నిధి నీదు ప్రేమే మాకు ప్రాణము తల్లి నీవే తండ్రి నీవే తల్లి నీవే తండ్రి నీవే దాతవు మా భ్రాత నీవే సాయి దేవా సర్వం నీవే సాయి దేవా సర్వం నీవే మనిషిని మాధవుని జయమదినే స్వర్గము గమాచ మాధవుడే అవతరించ సత్య సాయి భగవాను ఎంత ప్రేమయో స్వామికి ఎంత ప్రేమయో సత్య సాయి భగవానికి ఎంత ప్రేమయో ఎంత ప్రేమయో స్వామికి ఎంత ప్రేమయో సత్య సాయి భగవానికి ఎంత ప్రేమయో సత్య సాయి భగవానికి భగవానుకి ఎంత ప్రేమయో